High winds east, 21, gusting to 40 miles per hour. 39 degrees were seen, 40 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
To the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about a book that chronicles one of the most dramatic and troubling chapters in our country's history, the so-called Red Scare. It focuses in particular on what might more correctly be called the second Red Scare, because there was a first Red Scare, a deep fear of communism within the borders of the United States that occurred in the aftermath of the First World War. We are talking about the so-called Second Red Scare that occurred in the aftermath of the Second World War. And it is a story that many of us know something about, especially those of us here in Wisconsin, because one of the chief figures leading the Red Scare was Wisconsin's own Joseph McCarthy. But there is a great deal beyond Joseph McCarthy and those infamous hearings. And this story is told in methodical fashion in a new book called Red Scare: Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. The author, Clay Risen, is a reporter and editor for the New York Times, the author of a number of different books before this, including A Nation on Fire and The Bill of the Century. He is a member of the Society of American Historians and a visiting fellow at the Perry World House at the University of Pennsylvania. In his book, Clay Risen explores much of what was going on in the United States in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, and in particular talks about two different impulses that really helped set the so-called Red Scare in motion. One of them was a very high level of anxiety. In fact, he writes at one point, Clay Risen, the amount of fear in the air at that time is impossible to overstate, as well as how quickly it in turn distorted the debate over communism here in the United States. Those years right after the Second World War were full of anxiety and insecurity. It was also a time in which there was boiling resentment among many conservatives in this country over the ways in which the country had been reshaped through the policies of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his New Deal. And many of those unhappy conservatives were ready to lash out and, in a sense, take back a country that they felt had been taken away from them. A lot conspired, in a sense, to create what came to be known as the Red Scare. And it is something that not only played out in the hallways and hearing rooms of Washington, D.C., but played out all across the country. In fact, one of the things Clay Risen points out in his book is that committees devoted to the topic, to the cause of rooting out communists in our midst, rose up in state legislatures across the country, and in school boards and in small towns all across America. And there were a purging of books and organizations created like the Minute Women, with 400 chapters across the country. Films were boycotted. Blacklists were constructed and circulated. This was something that touched on many, many people's lives. The book again is Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America, published by Scribner, the author, Clay Risen. Clay Risen, one of the things mentioned in the publicity surrounding this book is that it was written at least in part from newly declassified sources. And I want to add that you began work on this book way back in 2019, so this book is a long time coming. Can you just give us a brief sense of the nature of some of those declassified sources and how helpful they ultimately were for you in crafting this book?
Yeah, I don't want to say that there's any bombshells in the book, but what they did, and these were a lot of FBI files, a lot of documentation from various sources involved in some of the congressional investigations, but it really helped give texture to the stories. I found material related to the Hollywood blacklist that helped me understand not just that the blacklist existed, but how the blacklist operated and how someone got on the blacklist and how they got off of it. I was also able to really flesh out stories about some individual characters who are not really famous in the story of American history, but are really, their stories bring to light and to life the experience of going through the Red Scare. So I was able to get their FBI files through Freedom of Information Act requests and really tell stories about them to help people understand what it was like.
I think one of the best things your book does is help. It helps us understand why this Red Scare occurred when it did. That it's not just because a gentleman named Joseph McCarthy, aided by someone named J. Edgar Hoover, happened to rise to prominence at a particular point and went on this witch hunt, but in fact, it's a more complex landscape and involving a couple of different matters that really set the stage for the Red Scare then to be unleashed. In a nutshell, explain kind of the crossing of political and cultural impulses that were at the heart of the outset of this Red Scare.
Yeah, so one sort of current that runs through the Red Scare is a cultural conflict between progressives and conservatives that had been boiling, or let's say simmering, since the 1930s, and sort of instigated and occurring around the New Deal, and then really came into its own in the 1940s after World War II with the onset of the Cold War and the fears and the sort of pressure for absolute security that came with it. And then when these two things merged, that, as I argue, is what really gave energy to the Red Scare.
One of the most interesting things about how all of this began concerns President Harry S. Truman and the executive order he signed in March of 1947, which instituted a loyalty program. And what is so intriguing about that is at least on paper, it was intended not only to, in your words, purge the government of disloyal employees, but also claiming to respect their rights. I mean, this was created, at least, again, on paper, as something that would safeguard against something appearing to be a witch hunt. And, of course, that isn't at all what happened. Why is it that the way in which this was conceived ended up sort of being activated in the one respect and not in the other?
Yeah, I mean, it was just a very poorly conceived program, and President Truman promised that it would take care of concerns about spies in the U.S. government. But by legitimizing fears that there might be subversives in the U.S. government, you know, essentially investigating every single employee for loyalty questions, it valorized and validated the worst fears that were being played on by red baiters. And so it allowed, sort of gave legitimacy to people who then wanted to go after actors in Hollywood and after teachers and after postal workers. And it really just spread out of control. And Truman later recognized that. And he said, it was not my intention, but I regret the way it played out.
You write at one point, Truman hoped it would be, meaning the loyalty program, a paper tiger, that it would impress many but affect few. And, of course, it really did that. And your book, of course...
Yeah, it really went the other way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your book paints a picture of a country in the immediate wake of the Second World War being deeply afflicted by fear. And a culture of fear is what, of course, ends up being the fertile ground for what we call this Red Scare. You mentioned something else about World War II itself, when you say the black and white logic of World War II would be extended and expanded in the Red Scare. What do you mean by that black and white logic of World War II?
Well, during World War II, there was an understandable demand on the home front for absolute security. There was a fear of German and Japanese saboteurs, and you know, the Japanese, that was not really the issue. Ironically, we put so many Japanese residents in concentration camps. While we didn't do that for Germans, not that we should have, but the Germans actually did send subversives and spies and saboteurs. So there was a lot of concern about that domestically, and the FBI exploded in size. You know, domestic counterintelligence and police forces exploded in size, and that logic and that architecture remained after World War II, and was one of the things that helped facilitate the Red Scare.
Your book chronicles, of course, the way in which this search for communists was carried out by a number of different agencies, but of course chiefly the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And I think a lot of us understand some of this, because of course this is the way in which so much of this played out in newspaper headlines and eventually on our television screens. And of course it was a particularly high-end and high-profile undertaking when the search for communism centered on Hollywood. And of course that's where some of the most dramatic events unfold. You tell us that Hollywood was a place that was, in a sense, attractive to the Communist Party, but that ultimately rather few members of the film industry joined the Communist Party, and that Hollywood was never as uniformly left-wing leaning as its critics often assumed. I appreciate the fact that you paint for us a somewhat complicated picture of Hollywood in the late 1940s and early 50s, a complicated picture that, of course, the fearmongers that were part of the Red Scare were not really interested in.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Hollywood was a place that was full of ideals and did have a lot of people who flocked to progressive ideas. Some of them did toy with the Communist Party, and a few of them were diehard communists, but they weren't the people who ran Hollywood. You know, Hollywood was and still is a company town. It's run by companies that have the interest of shareholders and owners and executives at heart. And so that was the tension. And so, you know, despite the fact that people thought it was this very progressive place, when push comes to shove, it was not. And that's why we saw the blacklist settle in and be so pervasive so quickly, because the studios saw it in their best interest to push that.
Right, and indeed, you talk about the studio heads who, generally speaking at least, were quite conservative and helped craft what you tell us was known as the Waldorf Statement that set in motion this thing called the Blacklist. We should say, though, that your
That's
book,
right.
for as much as you explore this and other things that people will have already certainly heard of, I appreciate the fact that you take the time to talk about people of a much lower profile who nevertheless saw their professional lives and to some extent their personal lives all but destroyed by this. Your book both begins and ends with a woman whose name I suspect will be completely unfamiliar to nearly all readers. It was unfamiliar to me. One Helen Reed Bryan. Explain why your book begins with this woman.
Well, Helen Reed Bryan was the executive secretary of a small group that helped refugees in the Spanish Civil War. And she was called before the Un-American Activities Committee. They were investigating her group. They demanded the group's papers. She refused them, and she went to jail for it. She was the first, I'd say, victim of the Red Scare. And when she got out of prison, she was hounded by the FBI for years, and it ended up in retirement. She had a stroke because of her experience and lived in Vermont and was still hounded by the FBI. And I won't give away the ending, but her story is exactly as you said. It brackets the story of the Red Scare chronologically, but I think it also brings to a point what it did to individual people, not just famous people, but thousands of everyday Americans.
Right. And one of the things you say in describing her plight and the plight of others, all it took was a single pointing finger to destroy
right.
a life. We're speaking with Clay Risen about his new book, Race, Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. I want to go no further without acknowledging something else that I think is so important about your book, which is that you not only chronicle the work of the House Committee on Un-American Activities and the efforts of people like Joe McCarthy and so on, but your book is also about something else, another aspect of the Red Scare. You write at one point, the Red Scare was never only about government overreach into the political lives of its citizens. It was also about the fever that it touched off with everyday American life, within everyday American life. And indeed, this is an aspect of this era that I knew very little about before reading your book. Explain why this is such an important part of the story and the way in which this Red Scare played out far removed from the hearing rooms of Washington, D.C., for instance.
Yeah, well, just one story, and it'll touch, hopefully, some folks there in your listening area. There was a day in 1950 in Mosinee when the communists invaded. This is in Mosinee, Wisconsin. And the whole thing was staged. It was an American Legion pageant, basically, but they took over the town and pretended to be communists for a day and rounded everybody up into the central square. And it was all just a show, but it was, the idea was to tell people and to enforce on people the idea that communists are everywhere, when in fact they weren't. There were no communists anywhere, except, you know, in a few big cities. And so and they certainly weren't trying to undermine the government of Mosinee. So, you know, this thing just got out of hand, but it got down into everyday life, and it had a huge chilling effect on how people thought about their engagement with the public. There were just things they couldn't say, things that were better not to engage with. And I think that had a long-term effect on American society. Mm.
You write at one point, to be labeled a communist was a social and career death sentence. And it's so important for us to understand that this happened not only to Hollywood screenwriters and stars and starlets and so on, but it might happen to the farmer down the road or the dentist.
That's right.
I also appreciate, as someone who is a music professor in my other life, the care with which you tell the story of the great bass baritone Paul Robeson and what he endured as a victim, as a target of the Red Scare, including a couple of different riots that ensued at places where he was going to give a concert, and in one case gave a concert, but in the aftermath of that concert. But the way in which ordinary people, ordinary Americans, were taking up the cause of rooting dangerous communists out of our midst, I mean, that's a scary, scary thing, and of course it has reverberations in the decades to the present day.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's hard not to wake up every morning, or it's hard to wake up every morning and not see a news story that resonates with some, you know, echoes of the Red Scare. I think it's something that's still with us. And it's a reminder of the need to always be on guard for civil liberties, not just of us, but of people around us. And it's often, you know, very easy for governments to pick on people who are vulnerable, pick on people who have unpopular opinions, as a way of controlling the rest of the population. And I just think the Red Scare is one of those signal moments that we should always remember for being a terrible time for civil liberties, and a reminder that we always need to be on guard.
Right. You're very careful to say Trumpism and the MAGA movement is not the same as McCarthyism and the John Birch Society, but there is a line linking them. And I appreciate the care with which you are talking about this, because I think it's very tempting for some writers to draw very clear, unbroken parallels. And you clearly think that that is perhaps a mistake.
I do. I think history is very useful for finding parallels and echoes and through lines. But history is also important for seeing where there aren't echoes, because it helps us understand our moment better. Not just to say that history repeats itself. Sometimes history doesn't repeat itself. And we need to know how that is, what makes our moment, whatever it is, unique and different from the past, and not just sort of knee-jerk finding parallels. But that said, I think, yeah, you're right. I think there are some clear through lines. The hatred of the federal government is something that really took root during the Red Scare and echoes through today. Conspiracy theories about the government are alive and well, and they have their roots in the Red Scare.
A last quick question. The Red Scare, of course, did not go on forever, even though, as we've just said, there are reverberations through to the present day. What is most important for us to understand about how and why the Red Scare, I mean, at least in its most vivid form, ended? What is most important?
Yeah, I think it's that a lot of people stood up over time. Individuals like Helen Ryan that are forgotten today, people like Edward R. Murrow, who stood up to McCarthy. And this was not one big sweep, but it was built up over time. And I think it really helped convince the American public and the courts and politicians to finally back down and to cool off. And I think it's that expression of individual courage that did a lot to bring the Red Scare to the end. And I think it's a lesson for today.
The bookend is Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America, published by Scribner, the author Clay Risen. Clay Risen, this could not have been easy to tell such an important and complex story. I appreciate the care, the methodical care with which you have researched this and told this story. Thank you so much for this important book and for the privilege of speaking with you.
Oh, I really appreciate it, Greg. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out today's program with a Morning Show interview from 2021 with best-selling author Larry Tye, talking about his remarkable book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. One of the things that makes Larry Tye's book distinctive from any that came before it is that Larry Tye was granted access to previously unavailable materials and resources in the personal archives of Joe McCarthy himself. The book is a careful chronicle of Joe McCarthy's life and career. We begin this excerpt with some comments Larry Tye makes about Joe McCarthy's unhappy experience in the military and the suspicious attitudes which he developed for military leadership.
So Joe McCarthy was a very famous and colorful name caller, and in his diary, he referred to the military brass with names like mental midgets and morons, and those are the kinds of names he ended up using over the years with most of his enemies. And he was not upset with his fellow grunts in the military. It was the generals and the people who were doing things he felt like not giving the soldiers enough good, healthy food that they needed, who were watching one branch of the military compete with another branch of the military that was putting at risk the soldiers who were out there fighting. And I think some of his complaints were legitimate. Most of his complaints were embellished. And how he would have known as a tail gunner, as a ground-based, you know, small intelligence operator, how he would have known what the truly high-up brass were thinking and doing it was well beyond his pay grade and beyond anything that he could truly see. And I think it was just his way of striking out against authority, which was a common theme throughout his life. Blame the brass, blame the president, blame the State Department, blame whomever. And it was just the idea of striking out and wanting to blame somebody is a natural instinct. The idea of doing it as often as Joe McCarthy did with as little evidence as he typically would have was an unfortunate instinct.
We're speaking with Larry Tighe about his new book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Let's talk about the beginning of McCarthy's career in the U.S. Senate. And you chronicle, I don't think we really need to talk about it here, but you chronicle his path to victory, and certainly all of the early campaigns that he waged, including the ultimately successful campaign that made him a U.S. senator, bear all the hallmarks of what we think of with Joe McCarthy and his tactics. Explain to our listeners a bit about what the very beginning of his first term as a U.S. senator were like, and the way in which he very much broke the mold in terms of how a freshman senator would comport themselves.
So on the one hand, he went in guns blazing from moment one. He went in making charges before he had really even taken his, been sworn into the Senate, making charges against, there was a major strike going on in the country then, and he talked about shooting people if they were doing what he felt was traitorous action in terms of a strike that would threaten the country's stability. He went in taking up causes of industry groups like the housing industry that was trying to build new housing for returning veterans. Instead of representing his fellow veterans, he was much more interested, it seemed, in representing high-paying housing developers. And he went in taking on issues that made him become dubbed the Coca-Cola Kid when he took on the interests of the soft drink industry at a time of sugar rationing. He went in essentially as a senator who looked like he was going to have a totally unexceptional career, was not going to make a name for himself other than as a toady to big corporate interests and as somebody who probably wouldn't get reelected. And that's the way it looked for a good half of his first term.
At one point, you write, a consensus was building. His career as a senator was more than just undistinguished. It was a train wreck. Even his fellow Republicans saw him as a gas bag and a pretender. I mean, that would seem to indicate that the political career of Joe McCarthy was not going to last very long at all. But you write then, Joe thirsted for a new cause that could salvage his career. And of course, we can all guess what that cause was.
So we can guess what it was, and yet until the very last minute, it was uncertain what it was going to be. He was invited to Wheeling, as his staff called it, Wheeling, West by God, Virginia, which was about as out of the way burg as you could find, to deliver a famous Lincoln Day dinner speech. On the anniversary of Abe Lincoln's birth, the Republicans all across the country would have dinners to try to raise money and to try to promote up-and-coming figures in the party. And McCarthy was enough of an undistinguished figure that the only place that he was invited was to go to West Virginia. He showed up at that speech with a briefcase that contained two speeches. One was a snoozer of a speech on national housing policy, which was an issue that he actually knew something about. The other was a barn burner of a speech on communism and on communist infiltration of the U.S. government, which was a topic that he knew almost nothing about. And it wasn't until he actually got there that he decided which of the speeches to pull out of his bag and deliver that night. Had he delivered the first speech on housing policy, we wouldn't be having this conversation today, and he would have been a one-term easily forgettable senator, but instead he delivered the other speech. Within a day or two, he was on the front page of every newspaper in America, and Joe McCarthy was born, and McCarthyism was given its birth.
Mm. There are a couple things about the way you describe this that I think are important to talk about. First of all, you say, and you've touched on this already, Joe McCarthy arguably was less well-versed in foreign policy and Russian statecraft than anyone in the U.S. Senate in 1950. I mean, that's a really important statement right there. But you go on to say, but nobody was better at reading America's pent-up fears and feeding them. And what a dangerous combination that is when you understand the pent-up fears of the average middle American and you have this innate ability to feed those fears. He had both of those capabilities.
He did. And one of the things that he realized in delivering that speech in West Virginia was lots of people had been pointing the finger at the Soviet Union and saying, you know, they may have spies here and we really have to be worried not just about what's going on overseas, but what's going on behind every pillar on our own government institutions. But very few leaders at that time had the chutzpah to name the traitors and point fingers at specific individuals. And McCarthy knew there was nothing better if you want to truly rile up the public than to stand there and say, as you wave the piece of paper, say, I've got in my hand a list of 205 traitors who are really undermining the security of our government. And, of course, every journalist in the world wanted to know what those names were. They wanted to print the names. They wanted to know from President Truman how he could allow people to exist in his government who were known security risks. And Joe McCarthy was off and running. And he was off and running in a way that he always stayed at least two steps ahead of the journalists and of his adversaries, because every time they would shoot down one name, he'd have two more the next day for people to print. And retractions in newspapers and corrections always get smaller print than the next day's big headline story of the new spy in town.
Hmm. And of course, as we've already said, Joe McCarthy had the issue he needed to snatch the limelight he craved. And I think it's really interesting when you talk about this matter of him having specific names and, you know, brandishing a piece of paper that supposedly had a long list of many names of suspected communists, that he was doing something new in this crusade, which did not actually begin with him, but which he, in a sense, perfected. You write, this time he grasped something earlier treason shouters had not, that counting and naming the actual traitors had a frontier justice allure. This changed the game, in a sense.
It did. Joe McCarthy he may have come from solid Midwestern stock, but he was a cowboy, and he understood that justice allure, and he understood that waving paper, counting supposed subversives, naming names, whether or not those names could be substantiated, his charges substantiated, that it worked. The press loved it, the public ate it up, and he soared from this backbencher who looked like he was on his way to electoral defeat to a senator who won an easy reelection and who became a national figure.
Mm. By the way, right after this first speech is given, you tell us about a very, very angry response to it penned by then-President Harry S. Truman. And here are the words. This is the first time in my experience, and I was 10 years in the Senate, that I ever heard of a senator trying to discredit his own government before the world. I am very sure that the people of Wisconsin are extremely sorry that they are represented by a person who has as little sense of responsibility as you have. You go on to say that note was never sent. First of all, how do we even know about that note if it was never sent? And help us understand why Truman refrained from sending it.
So I think we know about that note because Truman wanted us to know about it and regretted never having sent it. And so historians had easy access to it. But I think that it was never sent because more sober-minded people than our wonderfully fiery President Harry Truman said, if you give McCarthy the podium by having the president come out and take seriously enough what he did to attack him in that way, it will encourage this demagogue. That's exactly the kind of fervor that demagogues feed off, or the kind of national attention that they want. And on the one hand, Truman was right in everything he said except the wisdom of the people of Wisconsin and whether or not they would reelect him. But he was right that McCarthy was endangering American security more than he was protecting it the way he pretended to do. And the idea that he was bringing down and calling into question his own government was only a good thing if he could prove that that was a way of making the government stronger. And instead, he just undermined it, and he made it so that people didn't want to do government service. And it became an embarrassment for a time to work in the State Department because Joe McCarthy said the State Department had a spy behind every pillar. And I think Harry Truman's instincts were right, and his advisors who restrained him were right in the same way that being right doesn't give you ammunition necessarily to take on a demagogue.
Mm. You also mention in this portion of this book, of this chapter called An Ism Is Born, that it is not a surprise that this incendiary speech was not given in Washington, D.C., but someplace else, and that this was a pattern with McCarthy during this time. You call it a perk of the backwater, that Joe McCarthy would be very careful about where he would make certain announcements for certain kinds of reporters.
Yes, and so the kinds of reporters, the perk of the backwater was, if you make incendiary charges about what's going on at the State Department in a place where reporters have covered the State Department and would know who to call for a quick comment, would know what the record was of digging up spies at the State Department, and who could, in that same day's story, respond on deadline in a thoughtful way, that was dangerous. You didn't want to do it in front of those kinds of reporters. You wanted to do it in the people who were covering a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, a local newspaper that had no reason to ever write anything about the State Department except when Joe McCarthy came to town telling them about what was going on there. So you wanted to do it in a way that today, in our world of instant media and of global coverage, it would be easy to get the right reporters there responding immediately. In those days, it was the reporters out in the backwater who covered all of his early charges, and by the time he ended up back in Washington, his movement had been born, and it was too late to really rebut the things that he had said and that might have been rebutted had he said them to a Washington press corps instead of a rural America press corps.
Right. Another facet of this story, which I did not understand until I read your book, is that on the other hand, Joe McCarthy desperately needed the Washington press when, in a sense, it came time to move beyond vague hyperbole and supply actual names. I mean, and this is where suddenly he had to try to produce something which he, in fact, at that point in time, did not have specifics of specific people guilty of specific things. And he actually had to turn, among other things, to the press for assistance.
He did. So an effective demagogue knows how to charm the press when that is useful and how to attack them when that's the only option. And Joe McCarthy did both in a way that set a playbook. He worked with reporters. Two of the leading investigative columnists in America at that time are sort of a wonderful litmus test for what Joe McCarthy did. And they were a columnist, the most widely read columnist in America, Drew Pearson, and his young sidekick, who became the most widely known investigative columnist in later years, Jack Anderson. And at the beginning, Joe McCarthy courted them. he would let them listen in to phone conversations he was having with senior government officials. He fed them stories that they loved. You know, instead of the next day's charge on who was a communist going to everybody, he would feed it to a columnist like Drew Pearson and give him an exclusive. And in the early days, Pearson and Anderson used Joe McCarthy as one of their best sources. But as they increasingly saw that the information he had didn't stand up over time, they became increasingly skeptical. And instead of courting them, he went after them. He attacked Drew Pearson viciously on the Senate floor. He nearly beat him up at a session where they were both at a fancy social club in Washington. And Jack Anderson ended up hating McCarthy enough that he wrote the first critical biography ever written on Joe McCarthy.
You tell us that the Democrats in the Senate perhaps made a miscalculation in what would amount to kind of their first face-to-face confrontation with him, choosing to go toe-to-toe with him and, in your words, helping make him a martyr. Let's be clear, this is years before McCarthy's downfall. This is actually before his rise to his highest prominence. What was this kind of mistaken strategy of the Democrats at this crucial moment?
So the strategy was exactly what we were talking about with President Truman a bit earlier. It was confronting McCarthy with the names that he was raising and asking about each one and trying to show that people's earlier, maybe college-era flirtations with left-wing politics didn't mean that they were a communist, showing that a lot of the people who was pointing to as spies at the State Department didn't really work for the State Department ever or anymore. It was sort of taking name by name and trying to repudiate McCarthy's supposed evidence on those individuals. But every time they did, he would be jumping ahead with another name, or he would be calling their patriotism into question. It was, if you were somebody as verbally skillful as Joe McCarthy, he was like the brilliant trial lawyer who you could never pin down. And over time, they were the ones who ended up having the fingers pointed at them rather than them effectively being able to take down Joe McCarthy. And when he didn't win with them in a hearing room, he would take them on electorally. The senator who went after him the hardest was a senator, a patrician senator from Maryland named Millard Tidings. And he was the one who Democrats had named to chair a subcommittee that was going after Joe McCarthy. He was the one who wrote a damning report calling McCarthy the fraud that he was, and he was the one who saw a know-nothing Republican financed by and armed by Joe McCarthy take on the Senator Tidings, who looked like he was unbeatable, and beat him at the polls. And when Joe McCarthy brought down Millard Tidings, it sent a message to every enemy or every potential enemy that McCarthy had in the Senate: you take me on at your own risk. Beware my battering ram. And his battering ram proved incredibly effective.
I'm so glad that you take a moment in your book to acknowledge the only Republican who took a firm stand against McCarthy at this point, the Senate's only woman, Margaret Chase Smith. We've already talked about the fact that one of the most enlightening discoveries you were able to make was to probe the nature of the closed hearings behind closed doors, in which we see a very different Joe McCarthy from that seen in the open sessions, many of which were televised. You called these closed doors hearings a grand inquisitor's dream. But I think we'll leave it to our listeners to explore that and instead give you an opportunity to talk about how all of this comes apart for Joe McCarthy. This rapid rise to enormous prominence comes crashing down. And for reasons that are beyond the obvious and reasons beyond what we assume to be the most important.
Yes. So if we want to focus on his downfall, we should start out at the beginning of 1954 when Joe McCarthy had been taking on the U.S. military. He charged that at a base in New Jersey called Fort Monmouth, that it was a place where Julius Rosenberg, the famous atomic spy, had left behind a nest of his fellow spies, and McCarthy was going to root them out. And he started out that year, 1954, as the second most popular politician in America. A full 50% of the American public, the Gallup polls told us, thought Joe McCarthy was just swell. And the only politician who was more popular then was the President Dwight Eisenhower. But McCarthy was taking on America's mighty military machine. And that was an operation that wasn't going to be easily pushed around. That was an operation that arose, that finally got President Eisenhower angry enough at McCarthy that he was going to stand up to him. And in the famous Army-McCarthy hearings, where his fellow senators called him before a committee of inquisition and the Army, we saw Joe McCarthy at his bullying best. And by the end of those hearings, when McCarthy had appeared on television screens in every living room in America, and these were the most watched hearings, one of the most watched sets of hearings in the history of the American Congress, those hearings were Joe McCarthy's downfall. It became clear that his charges against the Army were partly trumped up. It became clear that he was like a barroom or a backstreet bully, and it became clear that America had invested much too much faith in him. He starts out that year at 50%. He ends up by that summer at the end of the Army-McCarthy hearings in the mid-30s. He had watched his popularity plummet. He was finally at a point where the president and where his fellow senators could effectively take him on. At the end of the McCarthy hearings, he was wounded. By the end of 1954, he was a political basket case. His fellow senators, in a very unusual action, had publicly condemned him, had said that he was a bully, and by the end of 1954, while Joe McCarthy would live for another 2.5 years, and while he would continue serving in the U.S. Senate, he was essentially a political corpse.
Mm. And I think it's important to acknowledge another line in your preface where you say, the more we learn, the fewer heroes this story has. There are a few, but this is also the story not only about Joe McCarthy himself, but those around him, and those who were in a position to perhaps stop him or slow him down, who for one reason or another failed to do so. I really appreciate the thoroughness of your book, the way in which you have looked at this in truly comprehensive fashion. The book again, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the author Larry Tye. Larry Tye, congratulations on a marvelous book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
So it was a blast being with you, and I appreciate your time.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Thomas Carr from the paleontology program at Carthage, who also is wearing the hat as Racine's co-poet laureate, talks about his Dinosaur for Poets program on tomorrow's morning show. And on Friday, Sam Ashworth, the author of one of the most fascinating, engrossing novels I have read in a long, long time, called The Death and Life of August Sweeney. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find it archived on our website, WGTD.org, and is available as a podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today will continue to be cloudy, windy, rainy, and warm. We do have the chance of some strong thunderstorms this afternoon with a high today of 66 degrees, winds gusting up to 40 miles per hour. Partly cloudy, windy, and mild tonight. A 30% chance of rain and thunderstorms tonight. Overnight low of 43. Tomorrow should be sunny with a high of 56 degrees. Very similar forecast for Friday, partly sunny, high of 53 degrees. A decent chance of rain both Saturday and Sunday with daytime highs in the low 50s. A little bit cooler first thing next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Receiving.